About two-thirds of U.S. states have relaxed restrictions in some significant way. Iowa is one of those. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Plenty to come this hour. First of all, this week, more loosening here in Iowa. Governor Reynolds announcing a series of decisions that allows more businesses to reopen as of today. It extends the business reopenings she allowed in 77 of our counties 2 weeks ago. That was on May 1st. This extends it to Iowa's other 22 counties. These are the counties with the higher rates of COVID infection and more fatalities. The governor has made her case for her approach to reopening in these phases numerous times in press briefings in the past few weeks. Let's get a medical perspective on the loosening of restrictions from Dr. Eli Perencevich. He is an infectious disease epidemiologist, also professor of internal medicine at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Dr. Perencevich, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
What is your reaction to the governor's steps to reopen over the past few weeks? Is she following the science, the data, the metrics in making these decisions, in your opinion?
I think to kind of give her the benefit of the doubt, she sees a lot more data than I do, and it's a very difficult decision. She has to balance the economy and public safety. And so she has the responsibility to make these decisions, and then she'll have to bear the responsibility depending on how things go. I think in certain counties, particularly in eastern Iowa, things are looking better, in Linn County and Johnson County and surrounding counties. But there are other areas that are very concerning, like Polk County and up in the Sioux City area, and certainly the counties with the large meatpacking businesses. Those areas are, in a different situation where I think we need still more physical distancing.
Mm-hmm. What are you watching? When you say very concerning, what specific data has your eye?
I think the overall number of cases, the doubling time of cases, and then several of us have been calculating the R-naught. That's the kind of reproductive number, which gives you a sense of how many new infections are caused by a single infection. And we want that number to be less than one. And some of these counties, the numbers remain above one. And so that's concerning. It suggests the outbreak is still spreading, and you don't want to open up when the outbreak is spreading.
Mm-hmm. As you mentioned full well, we're trying to do this reopening, keeping the economy, it is in tatters. What do you say to those as a medical specialist whose livelihoods depend on reopening? Many people are desperate to resuscitate their businesses even quicker than we're going now before there's really no business left to open.
Yeah, I totally understand a lot of friends and family in that situation. It's somewhat of a false choice in a way. I think the one thing I will say is opening up the economy only opens up kind of the supply side of things. I was an economic major back 20 years ago. And with supply and demand, you can open up businesses and provide the supply, but you really need to have a demand to make the economy jumpstart. So the key thing is to make sure the infection's controlled and people feel safe. I think none of us really want to get this infection, particularly those of us over 50 or with comorbid conditions. We just don't feel safe in the current climate, if you will. And so we need both. We need the supply, but we also need to figure out a way to make all the citizens of Iowa safe so they feel comfortable shopping and returning to business as usual.
Mm-hmm. It's in a sense, in the United States, we have 50 different lab experiments going on, so to speak, because of our system of government here. When you look abroad or to another state, do you see examples of clear, stark examples of what we don't want to do or do want to do as we reopen further?
I think there are some good examples that are kind of high profile, focus on the positive of what we should be doing. I think the poster child, if you will, of what to do is South Korea. They have experience from the Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, the MERS outbreak, which is a different coronavirus outbreak that really devastated them a few years ago. stay prepared and now have widespread testing and contact tracing. Thousands and thousands of tests are available. And so that's kind of the model. That's why in the United States, and particularly in Iowa, we want to really increase our testing levels and then our contact tracing. Testing's not that helpful if we don't track down every single person that person who's infected was exposed to and test them and isolate them. And we're not quite there yet in Iowa. I think there are a lot of estimates, but we need something like 10,000 tests a day in Iowa, given our current infection rates, to more safely open up. And so we really need to kind of put pedal to the metal and increase our testing capacity and establish contact tracing groups that can track these infections down and help control things as we open up. So that's the poster child. We need that.
Okay, so you put South Korea as a poster child of what to do, given what has happened so far, and this is far from over. We have a long ways ahead of us, but we know the United States by far has the most number of infections, by far has the most number of deaths so far. We are not going to come in the top half of performing well in handling this COVID crisis health-wise, are we? It just seems by that those two pieces of data there.
Yeah, I think if we continue without, expanding testing and contact tracing, it's true. Looking backwards, we haven't done that well. My focus and, things I've been sharing in the media and social media is really how can the United States, but particularly Iowa, how can we move forward given the constraints really protect people so we can kind of get them back out into society, get the economy going, get them back to their lives. So that's what I think the important focus should be.
Okay, and that leads us right to face shields. You are one of a group of infectious disease experts from the University of Iowa who believes social distancing measures could be relaxed sooner if everyone wears a clear plastic face shield. In fact, you and I believe two of your colleagues from the UI wrote an article about face shields last month for the Journal of the American Medical Association. Now, I tweeted this out, and I saw I have a face shield right now. I've tipped it up so that you'll be able to hear me, but I'll just tip it down so you can see, everybody can hear perhaps how my voice changes, and I can describe the comfort here. So now the face shield is down. Can you still hear me, doctor?
Oh, yeah, it's just fine.
Okay, so it's a little muffled, but it is, and I'm going to put it back up right now. It's quite comfortable when you compare it with a face mask, a cloth, or some other fabric, which most people wear. It looks quite different. Why are you a fan of face shields? Are you a fan of them over face masks, for instance?
Yeah, definitely a fan over masks. So just a little bit of history, some speaking, but this isn't my idea. Maybe it's easier for me to share others' ideas. This started about in January. The group at University of Iowa, the chief quality officer, Mike Edman, the chief of ID, Dan Dikema, the head of infection control, Jorge Salinas, and many others, realized we were running out of, or at risk then, it wasn't here yet, running out of personal protective equipment in our hospitals. We wouldn't have enough masks. And so they wanted to look at sustainable solutions, things that could be reused, which brought them to face shields. And so University of Iowa Hospital and Clinics several months ago bought 13,000 or more face shields, really high quality reusable ones, and distributed them to everyone in the healthcare system. No matter what job you have a face shield, even if you don't regularly see patients. And it's gone so well. I think, there are always hiccups. I think some of these heavier face shields, you get a little abrasion on your forehead or something. But overall, so well that we started talking about it and thought, why wouldn't this work in the community? Because, as you said, face masks are pretty uncomfortable. People don't wear them correctly. There's kind of a fun picture on Twitter that's going around that there are 16 things you shouldn't do with face masks. You don't have it below your nose and all these other things. So they're complicated to wear. People don't wear them that well, and they don't protect you. So face shields Well, face masks really contain your cough, but they don't protect you. You actually are more likely to touch your face, which is a big risk factor, and they don't offer any eye protection. And so face shields have a number of advantages. You protect your eyes, which, you know, if a cough or sneeze droplet ends up in your eye or you touch your eye, you can become infected, which people don't realize. It's a respiratory virus, so it's confusing. But that's strong data with coronaviruses that they spread that way. And then, they contain your cough and protect your whole face. So they protect others and you, unlike masks. And then for people that are hard of hearing, who need to read lips, or if you're in a crowded environment where you kind of need to rely on reading lips, face shields are better. And then there's also thought for children who need to see facial expressions. Right. It's much better for them and their parents, teachers, to wear face shields. So
right.
Those are the reasons I'm really
I talked with a child care provider who looks after many children, and she said the people she works with, the adults caring for these children, if a child was, you know, below the age of 3 or 4, they had to abandon the masks. They just weren't up to the task of understanding these masks, and they were terrifying to these kids. So that's an interesting remark. And also there, I think you point out, here's my mask here. It's easier to clean. You take some disinfectant, you wipe it like you wipe a counter, right? Not like cloth.
Absolutely. I mean, it's sometimes hard to find Clorox wipes these days. But yeah, if you have a wipe, Clorox wipe, that would work. And in fact, we all know, because we've been doing this for 3 months very well in Iowa, is we've been washing our hands with soap and water. And it turns out hot soap and water would be just fine way to clean your face shield as well. And so, so there are a lot of options there. It's much easier, quicker. You don't have to run the laundry cycle or whatever.
Doctor, we have about a minute left. Anything left to mention you want to sort of respond to in this context?
Well, I think one thing I would like our local and state leaders to do is consider face shields. I just found out today that the state of Oregon is mandating facial covering, including face shields, for businesses. And it may seem very anti-business, but I think we need to, it's a new world. And we used to have this kind of no shoes, no shirt, no service signs, you know, to go into businesses.
Sure.
And I think we could all put up with, for 6 to 9 months or 12 months till a vaccine arrives, it should be no mask, no shield, no shirt, no shoes, no service.
Well, who knows?
Complicated. Yeah.
Maybe we have these rudimentary face shields now, and they may become a fashion item. Who knows?
Yeah, there could be, brand names could get involved. I know Apple's making millions a day and Nike, so they'll get into it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Dr. Eli Perencevich is an infectious disease epidemiologist, professor of internal medicine at the University of Iowa, Carver College of Medicine. We appreciate your view, doctor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Be well.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, we're less than 3 weeks away from a primary election here in Iowa on June 2nd. This Friday and next here on News Buzz, we'll be airing Clay Masters interviews with 4 Democrats vying for their party's nomination for the U.S. Senate race. The winner of the primary race will face Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst in November. That's her first bid for re-election. In a moment, we'll get to know Des Moines businessman Eddie Morrow. But first, here's IPR's Clay Masters profile of Des Moines attorney Kimberly Graham.
But if this time can teach us anything, it's that everyone counts. Every nurse.
This video posted to Kimberly Graham's website flashes doctor, faces of people looking into the camera as she narrates. She identifies them as doctors, nurses, and drivers. For her job, Graham represents abused or neglected children in the recovery court program as an attorney. She started thinking about running for office after the 2016 election of President Donald Trump.
All of that, and then watching the investments in children decrease over the 20 years I've been representing kids, all of that came together, and I just decided to look into what it would take. And I actually saw an ad for the Ready to Run boot camp at the Chapman Catt Center for Women in Politics at Iowa State University. That was in January, I think, or February of 2017. So before, I think it was before the president was even sworn in. And I signed up and went to that boot camp and got kind of a high-level introduction as to what it would take to run for office. And I looked around and looked at what offices were going to be coming up, you know, which people were up for re-election in the next several years. My son was 17 at the time. I didn't want to run for office until he was an adult. So I decided I would run for United States Senate. And here we are.
Graham says personal experience would help shape her as a U.S. senator representing Iowa.
I've been working since I was 14. My parents divorced at 13. And so if I wanted anything but food and a roof over my head, pretty much, I had to go pay for it myself. And I did. And I had to take out a lot of student loans to get through college and through law school. And after 20 years of making on-time payments every month, I owe more now from law school than I owed when I left law school because of the absurd loan sharking type interest rates. And the income-based repayment plans actually create a situation where you get more and more and more in debt every day. And people that don't have student loans sometimes have no idea that this is going on in this country, that we are actually saddling people with massive amounts of student loan debt that continues to grow so that private corporations like Navient and Sallie Mae can make lots of profit off the backs of people whose parents couldn't afford to pay for their college or their graduate school or their professional school. So all of that, I think, affects how I look at things.
Graham got into the race in May of last year and says, like every candidate, has had to move everything online. And when it comes to the pandemic, she says as a senator, she'd put people above profits when it comes to legislation.
And when we do that, ironically, we'll have plenty of profits. We may not have the higher number of profits that perhaps some shareholders and, you know, corporation owners would like. But I firmly believe that those companies that invest in their employees, value their employees, pay them well, treat them well, are generally successful companies. And so in the stimulus package that came out regarding COVID-19, it appears to me as though the emphasis was still profits over people. It was still investing and giving bailouts to massive corporations, and in some cases multinational corporations, who actually don't need them. You know, we saw the well-publicized case of Shake Shack, who were given $10 million and returned it and said, look, we're okay. We don't need this. We have the capacity to ride out, at least for now, what's happening. But these small mom-and-pop businesses, like on our rural town squares and in some urban, economically disadvantaged areas, they don't have that extra money or the access to capital from regular channels, like regular banks, to get that increased funding that they need to ride out this storm.
That's Kimberly Graham, one of the four candidates running for U.S. Senate next month as a Democrat. Clay Masters, Iowa Public Radio News.
That was Clay Masters in conversation with Democratic Party Senate candidate Kimberly Graham. Next, let's listen to Clay's profile of another Democrat in the June 2nd primary, a candidate looking to face Senator Joni Ernst in the November election. Now Clay's profile of Des Moines businessman Eddie Morrow.
Senator Joni Ernst supports policies that leave Iowans with one arm tied behind our backs. I'm Eddie Morrow, and I'm here to change that.
Eddie Morrow is a small business owner, but he likes to point out he's also been a teacher and a coach. In 2018, he ran for Iowa's 3rd Congressional District, but lost to now Congresswoman Cindy Axne. When asked why he's running for Senate now, he says Iowans are looking for leaders to address problems facing the country.
And this moment in time now is even more critical that we really need some leaders that have done the kind of work that I've done. Our United States Senate remains broken, and both parties are to blame for that. We need to have some leaders that want to go out and actually lead for the people of the state of this country first, and not be beholden to corporate donors and special interests.
Morrow says his experience is broad and vast, and he points out that he's worked and taught in rural, urban, and suburban Iowa. He owns an insurance brokerage firm with offices across the country.
I work with small business owners in particular in every county in the state. I've been doing that for over 20 years now, helping them not only protect their assets, but also helping them with consulting in their small business endeavors. And we're out reaching out and talking to a lot of small business owners right now in particular about how you weather this particular struggle that we're all in the midst of together. I manage and handle hundreds of billions of dollars of aggregates and assets across this country and work internationally with insurers to protect small business owners. And again, that kind of background, dealing with those kinds of dollars, dealing again with crises of all kinds, whether that's hurricanes or tornadoes or earthquakes or floods, those are things I've been doing for a very long time. That kind of background is also down, granularly down right to main streets and town squares, Clay. And I've been working with those main streets and town squares in Iowa for 20 years now.
Morrow says his experience would also help guide him as a senator responding to the coronavirus pandemic.
If I was in the United States Senate, I would have been demanding that we were better prepared, and we were ill-prepared. We had the capabilities in place once upon a time. This isn't something that is brand new to everybody. I know the Trump administration acts like that, you know, nobody could have envisioned this. Well, it was envisioned by some very smart people, and they were working with policymakers and elected officials about how to be prepared, and this administration pretty much wiped that out. I think we also need to make sure, Clay, that we have people that are going to be straight with us and be honest with us, and that's not happening right now. At the federal level, for sure, and even lately, recently, at the state level, I'm a little disappointed in what we're doing now at the state level relative to that. Our website is the only one out there that has a pandemic response plan in it, that we're making sure that we're leaving no stones unturned, that we're making sure that all of our frontline workers are protected, that we're providing a universal basic income to every American that's 18 years of age and older. Throughout the pandemic, right now we've only given $1,200 so far to a lot of folks. Many people are still looking for their $1,200. I'm hearing all the time of people still haven't seen it come through yet. They're asking, who do they go to? There's nobody answering the door for them to get that. So we need a better centralized leadership out of D.C. and we're not getting it right now.
That's Eddie Morrow. He's one of the four candidates running for U.S. Senate next month as a Democrat. Early voting in Iowa has started for the June 2nd primary, and you can learn more about this election at our website, iowapublicradio.org. Clay Masters, Iowa Public Radio News.
That was IPR's Clay Masters in conversation with Democratic Party Senate candidate Eddie Morrow. Next Friday on NewsBuzz, we'll listen to Clay Masters' conversations with the other two Democratic Party Senate candidates, real estate executive Teresa Greenfield and retired Navy Admiral Michael Franken. Coming up after a short break, an Iowa business leader with his take on the COVID crisis, and new research from the University of Iowa studying the potential effects of helicopter rides that has led to the discovery of a potential stroke therapy. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a few minutes. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's continue our series of conversations with Iowans from all walks of life to find out how different people are coping with the global health and economic crisis caused by COVID-19. Gary Watts has worked in the real estate sector for over 40 years. He's the president and CEO of the Watts Group, a family real estate business based in Coralville. His company has about 30 employees and is involved with every aspect of real estate, construction, realty, rentals, and development. Gary Watts joins me now. Welcome to the program, Gary.
Good afternoon, Ben. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hope that first off the bat that your family and your loved ones are healthy at this time.
Everybody is. So, yeah, we're very fortunate and feel blessed that we are.
Okay. Let's go back in time a little bit. I'm guessing it was sometime in March. Take us back to the day or the week when you realized this pandemic was going to be a really big deal for our country, for our state, for your business.
I don't remember the exact date. I was trying to think about that the other day, but I think you're right. I think it was in that first week of March, and a lot of news reports, you didn't know what to believe. But then I think as it came out, I think probably that first week of March, we started to realize, that we needed to do certain things to, for our offices. We have a lot of maintenance people that were trying to get in and do maintenance in apartments. And, a lot of people were saying, what are you doing about it? And so we regrouped. I think we talked to the state of Iowa. They had certain procedures that we needed to go through. And, you know, we were kind of classified, I think, at that time as an essential service and in the real estate and rental business and construction. But we immediately, you know, got together, and I think they might have talked to the Center of Disease Control and find out what they were talking about, and, you know, came up with, you know, we weren't letting people into our offices. People were paying the rent in a vestibule. You know, they had to come, if they came in, they had to have an appointment only. And we started doing, you know, several things that that were required, I think probably early March, as I remember.
Mm-hmm. Give our listeners an idea of the number of properties that you manage, both residential and commercial properties owned by you, but also owned by others. How many renters are we talking about in commercial and residential terms?
Well, we have about 1,200 apartments. So as far as the number of tenants, you know, I couldn't give you the exact number, but it could be, you know, north of, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 folks. You know, we mainly manage properties in this area, North Liberty, Coralville, and Iowa City. And we have a little bit of Kirkwood, a few apartments in the Kirkwood that we rent to the Kirkwood students.
Now that we're several weeks into this crisis, what have been the biggest impacts on your business here? How have you had to adjust?
Well, initially, a lot of our maintenance issues, a lot of people didn't really want us in their apartments, so we just kind of said, fine, unless it was an emergency. Obviously, if it was an emergency call, we obviously took it and tried to deal with it. But it started out where, you know, the rent collections, and, you know, we were a little worried about that as far as residentially. But they came in, you know we might be seeing maybe 3 to 5% in rent losses. For this last couple of months, it's been mostly residentially. You know, we had very few delinquencies, and to our commercial tenants, a lot of those folks just kind of deferred payments for a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Talk about another aspect of the Watts Group business. I understand you, the Watts Group manages construction of new residential and commercial properties. So you're involved in keeping a good number of construction, tradespeople in work. Give us an idea of how much new construction you do every year.
Well, residential, you know, we do residential construction, we do commercial. Residentially, you know, I think so far to date we've sold about $13 million worth of real estate. We usually do a total amount of residential in the 15 to 20 million range. That's anywhere from our subdivision homes, we do duplexes, we do townhouses, single families, and we do single family custom homes residentially. We also do some mixed use commercial. Like our projects in Riverview Plaza here in Coralville and in Iowa River Landing, that would be a combination of apartments, condominiums, and commercial space on first floor. So, you know, we're also doing a body shop for a car dealership in North Liberty. So on an annual basis, we'll probably do a total volume in the 28 to 30 million range,
mm-hmm.
both
so
residential
I'm just...
and commercial.
Right. So I'm wondering, I drive around town and I see construction workers out working on new sites. Has COVID-19 impacted the progress of construction in any way? Or is it just, you know, these tradespeople, these construction workers have to abide by the restrictions, the policies that our governor has set out?
Yeah. As far as the Watts Group, as far as our residential construction, most of our construction was done about that late February, early March. So we were just wrapping up with things. So we didn't have the full impact of the pandemic. But what we have had is some of our custom homes, some of the cabinet orders, some of the special orders that we needed, and possibly countertops, cabinets, light fixtures, have been delayed a little bit because of COVID, because of manufacturing were slowed down. Certain plants weren't operational for a while, and it was slower to get things in on our homes and our projects, but not substantial. You know, where it might take 3 to 4 weeks to get cabinets, it might take us 6 now, but we're still working through it. And sometimes we had to switch vendors, you know, to find the cabinetry and the things that we needed. But we were kind of fortunate in the Watts Group where a lot of our projects were done early spring or late winter, and we didn't have to run into a lot of shortages in materials. Mm-hmm. As far as our commercial projects, it was similar. It wasn't really affected. at all for the type of materials that we were getting in here that it didn't really hurt us. As far as our workers go, the guys inside were wearing masks and doing what they could do and cleaning their hands. Obviously, framers and guys outside, it didn't really affect them as much. But our guys, when they're doing the finished product inside, definitely did the precautions that the governor laid out here in the last couple of months because they're more inside finishing things up.
Right. Right. Has the Watts Group applied for or received this any government aid, the PPP, the money that is meant to help keep employees on the payroll? Did it prevent layoffs? Have you had layoffs?
Yeah. Well, yes, we did receive money. We did apply for it. There was a period, I think it was, I don't know, about a month ago. I don't remember the exact date, but we did apply for it in two of our companies, in Watts Group, Inc. and then Watts Group Rentals, and we did receive money. And at this point, we've not laid anybody off. So we've been very fortunate. We've had a couple of folks that have had to work from home with daycare situations, and we certainly understand that. But in most instances, we're still here operational and kept a full force working. So we're pleased and we feel blessed that we can do that.
Congratulations on that. Have you, Gary, been satisfied with how our government has handled this crisis? At a federal level, at a state level?
It's a tough question. I think it's something that you hear about on the news all the time. My attitude is I think everybody's trying. It's kind of like, you understand one side of it, you understand the other side, nobody wants to see anybody have the disease or get hurt. Everybody wants to be respectful to each other. I think most Iowans, the way I see it, are respectful to each other and understand how difficult this situation is. And so, when I go somewhere and it's one-way traffic or a six-foot, you're waiting in a store and you wear a mask, I respect however people feel. I think it's good that we're doing that. We're trying to distance ourselves. I think it's been very hard to do, but I certainly appreciate what we've had to do to reduce the numbers and number of people that are affected by the virus. Mm-hmm. Saying that, I also think that hopefully, little by little, we can start to open up some things. I think we have to be smart about it. I think we have to, respect each other and take the precautions. But I hope that little by little that we can start opening up different parts of the economy and get businesses back in business. But I think we have to be smart about it. And I think also, just my two cents is I think it's a new normal. There may not be a lot of real large social gatherings until we get a vaccination. Right. I think it's just going to be different. There'll be lots of new things that we're going to encounter until that happens. But I think we're going to have to move forward. Things have changed. I've done more Zoom conferences than I ever had, but they're fine and they're very productive.
We all have. Gary, to finish up here, as I mentioned at the outset, you've been working in the real estate sector for over 40 years. Are these current conditions the worst you've ever experienced?
Thinking about that, this has happened in the last 2 months, this pandemic, and we were at such a high, we felt, unemployment was down, the stock market was up. Seems like things were, rolling along fairly well. Then all of a sudden this hit. And so I think we're gonna come out of it. I think we're gonna, once we figure out a vaccination and people know that they've been tested, and I think we're gonna come out of it. May not as fast as what we initially thought, but I think little by little that we'll be fine over time. I think a time that was more difficult, Ben, for me, was in like 2006, 7, and 8, maybe 9 even, where we were on a high in the early 2000s. And then I call it the Great Recession, where a lot of things changed in the real estate world that I saw, and with valuations and with appraisals and lots of things with interest rates. I'd say more 7, 8, 9 was more difficult than what I'm seeing now. Now, when I say that, this isn't 6 months down the road. I'm just talking as of right now, a snapshot in time. But what we saw was that went on for 3 or 4 years, and that was very difficult that time.
Interesting. Okay. Well, we may check back with you in the future, Gary. Hopefully, this doesn't get too much worse, and maybe we're in the trough. We can get out of it, and business will resume. We appreciate you talking with us today, and wish you and your family and your company continued success there.
I appreciate it. Have a good one, Ben.
You too, Gary. Gary Watts, an Iowa business leader. He's the president and CEO of the Watts Group, a family real estate business based in Coralville. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, when someone suffers a stroke, a sudden interruption in the blood supply of the brain, time is of the essence. And that's why patients are often transported by helicopter to a medical facility. New research from the University of Iowa studying the potential effects of those helicopter rides has led to an amazing discovery, a discovery of potential stroke therapy. It's a new study from the University of Iowa published this week in Stroke, the Journal of the American Heart Association. The senior author of the study joins me now, neurologist Dr. Enrique Lera. He is director of cerebrovascular diseases at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. Dr. Lera, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Ben.
Describe what you did in this study and what you found.
Well, as you mentioned, helicopters are very important in rural areas to transport stroke patients rapidly to medical centers. And we were interested in knowing for years what are the effects of these helicopter flights when a patient with a stroke is transported with the clot-busting medicine called TPA, because of all the different physical factors present in a helicopter, which are rather unusual. So this is an area of interest that needed to be investigated. And in order to do that, we designed this experiment using an animal mouse model of a stroke, where the mouse that has a stroke can receive the clot-busting medicine, just like a patient, at exactly 90 minutes, and we randomize these animals to receive the treatment either on the ground in normal conditions or in an actual helicopter flight or a third arm in a simulator that reproduced the vibration of the helicopter but not the other physical factors present in the helicopter. And what we found is that the mice in the helicopter did a little better than the ones in the ground, but not significantly better. However, the mice that received the treatment for a stroke while being shaken in the simulator platform with the vibration of the helicopter, they had lower stroke volumes, that means less stroke, and better neurological outcomes, suggesting that the low-frequency vibration that a helicopter generates may positively interact with this stroke treatment, TPA, clot-busting medicine, and could potentially improve outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, have there been instances when there's been a stroke victim in a helicopter where you thought, there must be something about this ride, or any of those indications?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's funny that you mentioned that because we all have anecdotes in the stroke world of patients. And, you know, I remember one coming from Mutangwa that, you know, the patient had aphasia, couldn't talk because of a stroke. So they got the clot-busting medicine started in the local hospital. They put him in a helicopter. And it was not until the patient was in flight that the clot broke and actually told the medical crew, turn around, I want to go back home. Which they didn't, fortunately. But, you know, these type of anecdotes made us all wonder if actually the vibration did something to the clot. But that was very, although everyone had these little experiences, that was very hard to test in humans because you cannot do it in a rigorous way. You know, the patients had to be transported, you know, for emergencies. So that opened the possibility to do it in an animal model of a stroke where we could control these variables adequately and make sure that the effect, if there was one, was real.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating. Before we go, so these are preliminary findings. What has to happen now before perhaps people will get this, if they have a stroke, get clot-busting medicine in combination with some sort of vibrating table?
Well, that's our long-term goal, but, you know, that is years away, because what would have had to happen is that this effect that we found has to be confirmed in other settings, in other models, with different variables, and ultimately tested in humans to see whether the effect is actually beneficial. Now, we are optimistic because in any treatment that you evaluate, you always have to compare the risk with the benefit. And the risk of low frequency vibration is really quite low. You know, it's a this is a physical force that we're all exposed in during transportation, during a variety of life events, and it's being studied as a safe form of energy. So that is encouraging, right? Because if the therapy is potentially safe, whatever benefit is found down the line can be really helpful for patients.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much. Senior author of a new study, neurologist Dr. Enrique Lera, director of cerebrovascular diseases at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine. A new study from the University of Iowa published this week in Stroke, the Journal of the American Heart Association. Dr. Lera is an author of the study, but there were lots of people involved in this, weren't there, Dr. Lera?
Yes, this was a team effort at the university, you know, from multiple colleges, the College of Medicine, the College of Engineering, and, you know, I cannot acknowledge them all, but at least I would like to mention Dr. Chauhan, Ramatala, Schnell, People Labs, which were instrumental in having this research done through a team effort.
Okay, good luck with further research on this potentially promising stroke therapy. Dr. Enrique Lera, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for having me.
And you can see a picture of Dr. Enrique Lera there next to the research helicopter he spoke of in his flight suit and helmet at iowapublicradio.org. And to finish up this hour of News Buzz, let's groove into the weekend. Mark Simmet is with us of Iowa Public Radio Studio 1. Hi, Mark.
Hello, Ben.
Well, you've got a couple of tunes. We've got just enough time, I think, to squeeze in two tunes. What do you got for us?
Okay. Well, first off, we have Lucinda Williams, definitely a core artist here at Studio One. Been playing her probably since the beginning, I would think, of her career. She has a new album called Good Souls, Better Angels, and it's a kind of a somewhat critical commentary on the times we live in. It was actually recorded before the COVID-19 pandemic, but she also offers some songs of encouragement on the album. And this is one of them. It's called When the Way Gets Dark.
When the way gets dark, your spirit, we lose your heart. When the way gets dark, we lose your fire, we lose your spark. Don't give up, hang on tight, don't be afraid.
Who doesn't love that voice? Lucinda Williams. Take us out with one more tune, Mark, please.
Yes, next we have Laura Marling, a British singer-songwriter. She releases a new album every couple of years or so, and she has a new one out now called Song for Our Daughter, and the daughter in this case, an imaginary daughter that she is writing songs for. This one's called Alexandra, and I really like the kind of early 70s Laurel Canyon vibe, Joni Mitchell-like feel of the song.
What became of Alexandra? Did she make it through? What kind of woman gets to love you? Wrote us all a little note, nothing left to lose. What kind of woman gets to love you?
As a big Joni Mitchell fan, my ears are perked up. Mark Simmet, thank you very much. IPR Studio One host. Your daily soundtrack, check it out every day. Thanks, Mark.
My pleasure, Ben. Thank you.
River to River is produced by Matt Alvarez, Caitlin Harrop, and Rick Brewer. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Have a wonderful weekend and stay safe.
If she thinks she'll be understood, pulls her socks up to her knees, fast.